At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When economists do it, it's called adjusting for inflation. When consumers do it, it's called just plain depressing. We learned this afternoon gasoline has tied its all-time high price, $3.22 a gallon, which matches the inflation-adjusted pump price from 26 years ago. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist magazine, which tells not only what's happening around the world each week, but why. The Economist, at newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. And by Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday today, May 21st, and it is good to have you here as always. It's one of those records that nobody really wants to be around for. And since 1981, on an inflation-adjusted basis, none of us has. The Reagan presidency was 2 months old the last time gas was this expensive in today's dollars, and yet we're using it like it still costs just $1.35 a gallon. We've called Tom Kloza at the Oil Price Information Service to help us make sense of 2007's gas and oil prices. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kai.
So here we sit at $3.22 a gallon for gasoline, and yet they tell us, all the experts do, that demand is on the rise. What happened to the law of supply and demand here with gas prices?
Well, I think you're seeing a staggered or delayed reaction right now. We're going to see some changes here in the next month or so, because beyond and above the sort of average price for gasoline, there's really the local price. And in some states right now, people are paying 50 or 60 cents more than they paid in the same week last year.
But there is this thing with gasoline demand, Tom, where it's sort of inelastic. If you have to drive, you have to drive.
Yeah, and there is that aspect of it. But there's also an aspect of it that has an emotional response sort of within the population. People will do some crazy things when it involves gasoline. And, you know, there's also this myth that you really can't do much about it, that, you know, you've already cut back as much as you can. And really, if you had a large percentage of the population drive by the equivalent of a half a coffee cup less per day, you would have a dramatic tilt down in demand.
Let me put you on the spot for a second and have you look past sort of the summer driving season. Are we going to back off these highs, or is it going to keep up for a while?
The combination of a little bit extra production coming on from refiners that were down for maintenance and a little bit less demand should cause us to level off and maybe even back off. The problem is there's another round and another ascent on all-time highs that could come around the end of July, when there will be probably almost hysterical reaction or looking toward Category 3, 4, and 5 storms in the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean. And nothing drives a market like fear. And my suspicion is wherever we back off from, let's say, this weekend through early July, we'll probably reapproach those numbers when you start to turn on the TV and see the cyclonic cloud formations in the Gulf of Mexico.
Let me get back to that refineries issue you brought up briefly for a second. Are you confident that they're all going to get back online and get to production that we need?
You know, I'm not confident. There is another school of thought that says this is what's happening to the infrastructure now and a couple of things at work. Either some of the stuff is getting old or, you know, safety is such a paramount, almost obsessive issue right now that we're never going to be able to get to over 90% of utilization like we have in most of the years this century. I prefer to believe it's a statistical cluster. You know, if you flip 100 coins, you're going to have four or five in a row heads or tails, and I think this is just the luck of the draw here. But that theory will be tested in the next couple of weeks. If by the middle of June we're not producing another 100, 200,000 barrels a day more of gasoline, I'm going to start to worry a little bit and maybe move over to the other school. But I think it's more of a cluster than it is a new paradigm for the century.
Tom Close is the chief oil analyst at the Oil Price Information Service in Wall, New Jersey. Tom, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
We probably ought to mention oil right about here. Up $1.30 to $66.27 at the close in New York. That's for U.S. crude. North Sea Brent, which everybody else in the world uses to price their sales, closed over $70 a barrel. Let's stay with energy here for a bit. Electricity this time via, strangely enough, the Department of Homeland Security. New York City's electric company is getting ready for a much-needed upgrade. And Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports one clever high-tech executive figured out how to get the federal government to foot part of the bill.
Consolidated Edison wants to spend almost $8 billion to upgrade the New York power grid. The Department of Homeland Security isn't in the electricity business, but it's kicking in up to $25 million for a new electrical cable in Manhattan. Steve Ellis is vice president of Taxpayers for Common Sense.
This is just a subsidy for, you know, big business in Manhattan, and really is some place where we don't need to be spending taxpayer dollars.
But the Homeland Security Department says it wants to protect New York's financial district. That includes making sure the electric grid is secure. Jay Cohen is a Homeland Security Undersecretary.
If the bad guys are able to take down our cyber backbone, deny us the ability to make electronic transfers, then we're going to have, in my humble opinion, panic in the streets.
Con Edison says it wouldn't install the new cable without the federal money. The company says it's an experiment to see if new technology will work in a congested city. But even the businesses involved in the Con Edison deal say it's unusual for Homeland Security to fund an electricity project. In fact, Adam Hughes of OMB Watch, which monitors government spending, says it's bizarre.
Generally speaking, I think it's good for a government to be making these sorts of investments. I think it may be a bit of a stretch to say that this is a key terrorism prevention investment.
Hughes expects more electric companies to line up at the Homeland Security Department to ask for funds, too. In Los Angeles, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Down the East Coast a ways, the debate on the immigration bill began in the Senate today. If it passes, it would transform how America will pick its next generation of immigrants. The new system would give more weight to aspiring immigrants' education and skills. You'd expect high-tech companies to love that idea, but many in the business world, even in high-tech, still say it won't deliver the workers they need. Marketplace's Steve Henn explains.
If you ask Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez why the proposed immigration deal will be good for the American economy, he doesn't hesitate.
This is about getting the skills that our economy needs, and this is about ensuring that we can grow and prosper.
If the bill passes, America will start choosing its new immigrants differently, giving more weight to education. You'd think high-tech companies like Oracle, Hewlett-Packard, and Microsoft would love this idea, but they don't. Robert Hoffman is a vice president at Oracle and co-chair of Compete America, a coalition of high-tech firms. First and foremost, his group wanted more highly skilled workers to be let in. That's not what they're going to get.
We were asking for something easy, and the fact is that we're now being told that this bill has a system that is not what we asked for.
Under the proposed system, a well-educated philosopher could beat out a high-tech engineer. Hoffman says not all PhDs are created equal. He'd like to keep the current system, which lets employers choose the exact worker they need.
We believe that system in and of itself works extraordinarily well. It ensures that employee skills meet employer demands.
Today, some high-tech lobbyists on the Hill warn that this bill, as it stands now, simply doesn't work for their industry. They say if it's not amended, they may not be able to support it. And this is just one of many hurdles the Senate faces as it debates this bill over the next 2 weeks. I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
At the risk of sounding repetitive, today was a day of deals on Wall Street. Alltel announced it's being taken private by Goldman Sachs and the TPG Group. The $25 billion price tag makes it private equity's biggest step into telecommunications, yet anyway. And the British record label EMI was snapped up by the private equity group Terra Firma, $4.7 billion there. But all the same, something happened somewhere along the line that mostly turned investors off. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. This might sound kind of silly, but bear with me for a second. Imagine having $1 trillion in the bank, you know, give or take, and then realizing that just letting it sit there isn't really much of an investing strategy. It's a lesson the Chinese government finally seems to have learned. Beijing's holding about $1.2 trillion in foreign reserves. It announced a month or so ago it's going to start letting that money go to work for it. And today we learned exactly how, by buying into the high-powered U.S. private equity firm Blackstone. Scott Tong's covering the story for us from Shanghai. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. Listen, we've talked before on the program about China and its $1.2 trillion worth of reserves. Why are they investing part of this money in Blackstone?
Well, as you know, China needs to diversify out of having all its money in U.S. Treasury securities, the boring, low-risk, low-return stuff. And the thought is, first of all, that Blackstone is a group of people who know what they're doing. So as one investment professional told me today, they're paying tuition to learn from some of the best traders in the world.
Okay, so they've chosen Blackstone. Why this moment in time?
Well, there is a chunk of Blackstone that's for sale now. Blackstone is about to go public, and so they're putting some of their company up for sale, and so it was available for China. And the other reason is we've been waiting for months to hear some of the details of the state-owned organization that China has created to diversify where China puts its money. So it has been in the works for quite some time, and here we have kind of the first inkling of where they're going to put some of this money. Now, $3 billion, it sounds like a lot of money, but as you said, there are more than $1 trillion in foreign reserves here. So $3 billion is kind of the rounding error here, right? And China watchers describe China's economy and how leaders kind of steer the economy as crossing a river, feeling for one stone at a time. And if the next stone is a little wobbly, they'll kind of pull back. In other words, they'll go very slowly. And that's the idea here.
Scott, there is this Chinese trade delegation in Washington this week. They're going to meet with Treasury Secretary Paulson. This deal will probably come up in the course of conversation, don't you think?
Well, this is a significant deal. So there will be talk about this. And the sense is, this is a chance for China to say, we're taking some of these massive foreign currency reserves and we're investing it in an American company. And this comes at a time when a lot of American policymakers are worried that Beijing is going to take a lot of its dollar-denominated assets, its investments in American securities, and just dump those and create a lot of instability for the dollar in the United States. And this helps Beijing create the appearance that, no, we're not doing that. We're actually investing in America.
Scott, do you think this deal plays into the trade gap between the two countries, the revaluing of the Chinese currency, and sort of the larger dialogue that Treasury Secretary Paulson's trying to have here?
Treasury Secretary Paulson came to China a few months back for the first round of these talks, and he kept saying that China needs to move into the modern global financial system. And this is a way for Chinese leaders to say, hey, this is what we're doing. We're starting to diversify where we're putting our money, and we're casting some of our lot with very sophisticated investors in the United States. And this is a step that China's taking into this modern global financial system.
Marketplace's Scott Tong in Shanghai. Thank you, Scott.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
Today, Today was one of those days when there were so many deals announced, we need to break up the news just to avoid sounding like we're reading a list to you. General Electric confirmed it's going to be selling its plastics business for $11.5 billion. The buyer is Saudi Arabia's biggest industrial company, Saudi Basic Industries Corporation, or SABIC. The plastics division had been a money loser for GE as crude prices bumped ever higher. That's a problem the new Saudi Arabian owners likely won't have to deal with, seeing as how they've got an inside line on the key ingredient of most plastic products. It has been quite a run for mergers and acquisitions lately, but no matter how big or small the deal, conventional wisdom is you've got to have a business plan. Au contraire, says commentator and aspiring entrepreneur Rob Long.
There are two kinds of people in this world. The first kind, entrepreneurs, dreamers who will bootstrap a company from nothing in the hopes of a distant payday. And the second, well, everybody else, people who want to get paid regularly and on time. Now, the trouble begins when the second group starts working for the first group. See, along with any pitch to the bankrollers, you need a business plan, which is actually a document with a lot of financial stuff and business stuff and competitive strategy stuff that I, frankly, as someone who has written and produced television for 17 years, don't get. My brother does, though. He's got an MBA. He breathes this stuff in his sleep. So I, entrepreneur, ask him, consultant, if he'll write up a business plan. Sure, he says. And then I say, oh, and, you know, I understand this is a big deal. I'd really like to pay for your time. You know, thinking, of course, that what he'd say is, no, or something. But he doesn't. He says, yeah, I'll work out some kind of hourly rate and invoice you. Now, one thing about entrepreneurs, though, is that we don't wait. So while my brother was writing the business plan, my partner and I are meeting with potential investors. None of them wanted to see a business plan. In fact, we're sitting in the conference room of one of the biggest, most powerful venture capital firms in Silicon Valley, and the moment the words business plan come out of my partner's mouth, their senior guy shuts him down. I hate business plans, he says. The minute you write one, it's outdated. What I like are flexible, nimble entrepreneurs with a vision. Now, a week later, my brother sends me the business plan and an invoice. The business plan looks sharp and professional and totally convincing, and the invoice is on my desk under a pile of magazines. Because there are two kinds of people in this world, the people who like to get paid and the entrepreneurs who will take 180 days to pay them.
Rob Long is a commentator on KCRW here in Los Angeles. If you've got a comment you'd like to send us, let us know at marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. Coming up, the combination of church and state.
Really, what you're doing here is you're putting two separate legal systems alongside each other. And Sharia law can't sit alongside our secular democracy law at the same time.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dipped 13 points today, a tenth of 1% to close at 13,542. The Nasdaq climbed 20 points, 0.8%, finished at 2578. The S&P 500 rose briefly above its all-time high during the day, but then pulled back to close at 1525. That's a gain of 2 points, or 0.1%. Freight carrier EGL loaded up almost 3.75%. A bidding war for the firm continued between a group led by the company's chief executive and its rival, a consortium led by Apollo Management. Virgin Media rose about 7.25% on reports that private equity groups might put in a bid for the British cable firm. Hardware company Lowe's banged up about 2.5%. The nation's number two home improvement store reported a 12% drop in profits, partly because of the weak housing market. Overseas, the markets were mixed. Bond prices fell back home. The yield on the benchmark 10-year T-note rose to 4.79%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to the public radio music source, where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's happening on Tuesday. The 2007 National Geographic B Geography Finals kick off in Washington. Jeopardy host Alex Trebek emcees. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration releases its 2007 Atlantic hurricane season outlook. And a verdict is due in the copyright violation trial of a Polish translation of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. Selling the manifesto is banned in many countries. I'm Jane Lindholm.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Bush continues to stand by his attorney general. He said once again today Alberto Gonzalez has done, quote, nothing wrong. That's an opinion not shared by most Democrats in the Senate, quite a few Republicans, and by a guy named Robert Greenwald. Greenwald's an independent filmmaker. This morning, he posted a 90-second video online calling for Gonzalez to go. Hundreds of people have already seen it and emailed it to their friends. It's a phenomenon called viral videos, an offshoot of viral marketing. Distribution's effectively free and incredibly effective. Andrea Gardner looked into whether those videos might change political advertising.
It was just 4 months ago that filmmaker Robert Greenwald began making politically charged viral videos funded by private groups and donors. They're a far cry from the usual mix of viral videos online, skits made by teenagers, animal tricks, and snippets from TV comedy shows.
We're now having virtually everybody working on an issue coming to us and saying, how can we do immigration? What can we do about health care? I mean, it just goes on and on.
Greenwald's most recent video pokes fun at Alberto Gonzalez's spotty memory.
And answered every question he could possibly answer.
I don't recall specifically.
Every question.
I don't recall.
At the end, viewers are asked to sign an online petition. But as the 2008 presidential election draws near, political videos will ask viewers for their vote. Many expect the number of political virals to skyrocket. Private groups and average Joes will fund them, create them, and post them to the web. Republican campaign strategist Dan Schnur says videos like this are making political advertising much more affordable, and voters are more likely to watch and believe the message in a viral video because it comes from a friend.
You eliminate, or at the very least reduce, the inherent suspicion that most people have toward politics. Because the cost is so much less, you can afford to take some risks with humor, with more offbeat messages that you might not want to run on broadcast television.
That could bring in the youth vote. Schnur thinks Republicans and Democrats have equal advantage when it comes to creating viral because the technology is so simple that anyone can do it. But Greenwald says there's a skill set to creating videos that are funny and entertaining enough to compel people to pass them along.
Having said that, it's an incredible game changer. It's much less expensive. You can reach huge numbers of people, and it can have more impact.
Potentially giving lesser-known and lesser-funded candidates more equal footing in the coming race. I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
New York and London are caught up in a battle over which city will win out as the center of international finance. You can make a good argument either way, and it'll probably be years, if not longer, before we know. But London has an edge in a key growth market that New York and the United States might not be able to match. Britain could soon become the first Western government to issue bonds that comply with Islamic or Sharia law. And that could mean billions in extra capital flowing London's way, as our man in London, Stephen Beard, reports.
London's link with the Muslim world is vividly apparent here on the Edgware Road. Some people call this Little Arabia. There are dozens of Arab shops and cafes. Along the sidewalk, scores of people in traditional Arab dress smoke the water tobacco pipe, the hookah. Because of the Arab and Pakistani presence in Britain, Islam is the UK's second largest religion. At a recent conference, Britain's Economic Secretary Ed Ball said he would like to cash in on the UK's Muslim connection.
We think this is a very important opportunity for our financial services industry. We are determined in a concrete way to do what's necessary to make London the global hub for Islamic finance.
The British government has already changed the law to make it easier for Muslims to take out mortgages and other loans. But the latest plan is more dramatic. The idea to issue British government Sharia bonds, vetted by Islamic scholars to ensure they don't break any of the rules of Islam, which, for example, prohibit gambling and alcohol.
I believe this will further widen the appeal of London as a financial centre to the emerging Islamic finance industry.
Iqbal Khan is a leading British Muslim banker. He says if the UK becomes the first Western state to issue Sharia-compliant government bonds, it could eventually bring to London huge sums of money from the oil-rich Middle East.
The current size of the Islamic finance industry is more than $750 billion, that growing at 15 to 20%. So this is a very serious amount of capital coming through a financial centre like London.
London has already attracted a small amount of trading in Islamic corporate bonds.
Yeah, par 45? Par 40 on that. Okay, five of par 40, sold.
This is the dealing room of the European Islamic Investment Bank, which is based here in the British capital. London seems a more likely venue for this kind of trading than New York, says David Oakley of the Financial Times. For one thing, he says, the US government is wary of Muslim money.
An unnamed person in the US government, allegedly, I have to say, was said to refer, well, Islamic finance, is that terrorist finance?
The UK, says Oakley, is generally far more relaxed about Islamic finance than the US.
There is this hostility towards Islamic finance in America, dating back to September 11. There is just not that same kind of hostility in this country.
Not in the government, perhaps, nor in London's financial district, but there is some hostility in some quarters. Charlotte Thornycroft belongs to a group called the Lawyers Christian Fellowship.
Really, what you're doing here is you're putting two separate legal systems alongside each other. And Sharia law can't sit alongside our secular democracy law at the same time.
She says that a panel of Sharia or Islamic lawyers, not even based in Britain, would make decisions about British public spending. They'd decide how the money raised by the bonds could be spent.
You could, in theory, say you can't use this money for secular democracy teaching because it goes against Sharia law. You can't use this money for animal rights for certain animals because they're not halal. You can't use the money for media because it propagates gossip.
But devout Muslims here say that Sharia-compliant government bonds would help them feel more British and more Muslim. For London's banks and brokerage houses, however, the attractions are more basic. They have their eye on the ever-expanding tide of Muslim money flowing from the oil fields of the Middle East. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Waitress, a comedy about a diner waitress who finds inspiration in motherhood, friendship, and pies, in select theaters now. And by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we go today, there's been some unsettling news about GlaxoSmithKline's diabetes drug, Avandia. According to the New England Journal of Medicine, the drug increases the risk of heart attack by 43%. So far, more than 6 million people have taken it to treat type 2 diabetes. Glaxo says it, quote, strongly disagrees with the conclusions in the article. The company says results are based on incomplete evidence. The Food and Drug Administration has stopped short of taking any regulatory action, though it does recommend patients who use Avandia talk to their doctors or perhaps their stockbrokers. Glaxo shares fell 7.75% on this news today. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 13 points, 0.1%. The Nasdaq rose 20 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 just missed a new record, though it did pick up 2 points, 0.1%. Our producers include Jane Lindholm, Brett Neely, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, America's problem with drug money.
It costs about $1 billion, some people would say $1.2 billion on average, to take a drug from discovery in the lab to commercialization. And it's a very, very risky business.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.